8:02, the time on the Mornings with Ed show. Welcome to the program. We've been waiting for this conversation for some time. Well, when the pandemic pandemic broke and we first got involved with it here in the United States, Caduceus Medical Group started testing for COVID way back in mid-March. Overall, so far, they've tested over 2,000 patients and have so far actively treated about 100 patients. And with us this morning, we have Caduceus Medical Group Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Greg DiNicola, with us. Thank you, doctor, for being with us this morning.
Yeah, Ed, happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Today, sir, we're reporting the highest number of hospitalizations in Orange County since the start of the pandemic at 351. And those numbers have been climbing steadily. And although we had zero deaths reported yesterday, we've been seeing double-digit deaths pretty regularly these last couple of weeks. Of the 269 deaths so far, 174 of them have been in the last 4 weeks. Are we looking at an ugly July and August, or are you seeing any signs of promise?
Both, but the answer is yes. I did a little blog for our patients a couple weeks ago where I kind of warned everyone that it was going to be a long, hot summer and we were going to see an increase in cases. I certainly, personally, was in favor of reopening things. You can only stay locked down for so long. But I saw as soon as we reopened and then the beaches and the protests and people not wearing masks and all that, I saw that was going to lead to an increase in cases. So I think most physicians and public health experts saw this coming. Okay. On the positive side, I can only speak, though, for Laguna Beach now. Our Laguna Beach cases we've had recently are not as sick as they were 3 months ago. I know the hospitalization rate is higher countywide and the death rate is higher, but we still have not had any deaths in our practice because we treat it very aggressively. But at least now it seems like instead of 2 weeks, there's about 1 week of symptoms. Instead of half the cases being severe, only about 10-20% are severe. So we're guessing maybe locally where we are, maybe there's a mutation that has a milder strain.
Okay. And aside from a milder strain, could it also be the fact that maybe more young people are getting it and they're able to deal with
it?
Okay. That could be it as well?
Plus we're catching it much earlier now, but we were catching it in March and early April. People were quite sick. They had to be talked into being tested. They didn't want to be tested. And now people want to be tested immediately. So we're catching them really early. So that could be part of it. And yes, definitely more young people are getting it
too. Now, you spoke about reopening and possibly we reopened the wrong way. And the logic behind the wearing of masks to reduce the risk of spread seems so obvious. A couple of questions here. Is it, in fact, the best and easiest way to slow the spread? And of the 100 or so people that you've treated so far, what percentage would you say were consistent mask wearers?
Very few, to answer that question. I don't have an exact number in front of me, but I'd say under half and maybe even under a third. Okay. Were mask wearers. And when they got it, most people know when they got it. They got it from a roommate or a party they went to. And they admitted that the day they got it, they didn't wear a mask. Almost everybody said that. As far as the mask goes, the studies are pretty conclusive, so I don't understand why the controversy. A regular surgical mask that you could buy online and maybe borrow from the local hospital blocks 80% of all viruses, including COVID, that's been tested. Then the N95 is named that because it blocks 95% of the viral particles out. So, and then a cloth mask that's just kind of rinky-dink you can buy anywhere, make yourself, blocks over 50%. But if you double-ply it, it blocks 80 to 90%. So they work, there's no question. The other concern is that more recently, in the last 4 weeks, studies at a big medical center showed that the virus also can be transmitted through normal talking and breathing. You don't have to cough or sneeze. There was a choir in, I think it was Utah, that the entire choir got COVID because one member had it. But when you sing, you're blaring out your mouth.
Right.
So that's really scary because then you could, if both people weren't wearing a mask, get a transaction like a barista or a dry cleaner. If both people weren't wearing a mask, you could easily get it just breathing. So the mask is very essential. Yes, for the best. I think the best is still staying away from people as best you can.
Right.
Nothing magic about six feet. Most studies have shown it can travel much farther than that. But just common sense is the farther you are away from people, the less chance you're going to be able to get it.
That makes total sense. That, again, yeah, and I can't understand the opposition to the masks. It seems like such an easy fix. It really does. The distribution that you've seen here in the county between North Central and South Orange County, what's that look like? Where are you seeing the cases coming from here in the county?
Right. It's still split a third, a third, a third. That hasn't changed. I think if you rank them, probably the Laguna Beach testing is equivalent, but has less cases, but not a lot. Like if we get 10 cases up north and 8 in central, you might get 6 in Laguna. So it's less, but not that much less. Definitely the Laguna cases aren't as sick right now for whatever reason. Maybe, like you said, the age of them. But the sicker cases are all up north, no question. Mm. Also, not that many Laguna patients got it from work. Some, but most got it from socializing or a roommate or a close contact friend, party, that kind of thing.
Are you hearing any cases of anyone having gotten it at a grocery store or at a...
No, not for sure. That some people suspect maybe, but that hasn't been documented. I think if the number one we find over half the time, maybe three quarters of the time, is a contact with a person they knew had it. Like my roommate got a fever and they got tested, and then I got a fever and I got tested, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So most people can pinpoint exactly where they got it, or as a party where 2-3 people were coughing and then they eventually got it. So we're seeing it mostly person to person right now. Well, where we're not seeing it, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be doing this, but more and more the data says it's really hard to pick up off a countertop.
Okay.
And yes, we should have Lysol, no question. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't be hygienic. It's almost next to impossible to get it from a doorknob. It doesn't live that long on a doorknob. You know, I noticed my office is across the street from Circle K, and I ran over there to get a quick iced tea, and the soda fountain is down, you know, because you can't get sodas publicly, and the hot dog bar was down. I don't eat hot dogs, but I couldn't have got one if I wanted one. And there's really no evidence that you're going to get it from a soda fountain or a salad bar or a doorknob or a countertop. And those are all good things. We should definitely be hygienic.
Right.
But I think we haven't put our focus in the right place. Our focus is stay as far as you can and wear masks. Then I think reopening isn't going to be a big problem.
More so lung-to-lung transfer. Stay away from someone else's breath. Stay away from that line.
Yes, Dave, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you, I walk around, I'm not kidding, I go to the grocery store, I'm wearing gloves, I'm Mr. Alcohol with every doorknob. I'm that guy. I've been doing surfaces a lot. Am I going too far?
I think so. I think we're just prioritizing the wrong thing. Now, back in March, of course, I do a lot of reading, and back then, the so-called experts were saying it can live, you know, 10 hours on a table, and it can live 4 hours on a doorknob. Now that's all been debunked. Now they find that it's not it might live 10, 20 minutes on those surfaces. And so not that you shouldn't be careful, but there's so much emphasis on that. There's not as much emphasis where it should be. The studies now have shown that about 80% of transmission comes from nose and about 20% from mouth. Mm-hmm. And that's really where it lives, in our nose and mouth. It doesn't even get to our lungs till we're sick. Mm-hmm. So until you're really sick, it's... And so when you're breathing through your nose or talking, just that alone can shed virus. And that's where we're seeing a lot of transmission. That's why you could get it at a barista or dry cleaner if there's not mask wearing.
Right. So the person that wears the half a mask, the person that only covers their mouth with the mask and their nose, they're spreading it just as much then.
That's all. If it weren't so serious, it's almost humorous. I see the same thing. I go to the stores, it's done around their mouth, but their noses, that's where 80% of the virus is in the nose. So, and the plexiglass helps. Now you go to, you know, the various places in town, and there's plexiglass, and that definitely helps. It does not penetrate plexiglass, so that's safe, and that's a good alternative if you work all day sitting down and customers come up. Fortunately, most places have both. They wear a mask and plexiglass, but at least the plexiglass should work.
Okay. I read that over half of your cases are people under 40. Is that a result of the overconfidence that you have at under 40, and more of them are unmasked and not
now
exercising?
Now I would agree. Yeah, now that percentage has still stayed. Even that was the original. The number you just quoted was way back in April, but that I reviewed it for this interview, and we're seeing the same thing. Okay. Maybe a better way to think of it is under half, over half, or under 50 is a good way to look at it. And you could say, well, maybe they get tested more often. No, the seniors love to be tested. We do a lot of senior testing. And it is true the seniors get maybe tougher cases, harder cases, because their immune system's lower. But in general, the typical person's 40, 50 years old, but active, social, goes to work, you know, hangs out with people, runs errands, and those kind of things.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, nothing.
Is it the same regimen for seniors? Is it just as aggressive a regimen that you use for seniors as you do for people under 40?
Yes, we try to match it to the symptoms, though. So we would treat a moderately ill 70-year-old the same way we treat a moderately ill 40-year-old, maybe a little more aggressive, but the same way. The 70-year-olds seem to get it easier than a 40-year-old. But, you know, we had a 21-year-old female, that was about 6 weeks ago, but boy, she was really, this was Laguna. She was really ill. I mean, she made it, but she could barely breathe. The flu was building up, and she was 21. Wow. She got it at a party. She knew exactly where she got it. There was a party, and somebody at the party had it. So that's where I think we're just not being careful, is how close you get to people and whether or not your mouth and nose are protected. So I'm not against reopening at all. I think we had to reopen, but maybe we need to just pay a little more attention to blocking the virus and distancing.
Right. There's opening, and then there's opening really smart. My question about the 21-year-old, was she a vapor or a smoker or anything that...
Let me think. No. I don't know. I don't recall if she was a vapor. She was not a smoker.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
She was a partier. She was very social and went to a lot of parties.
Right.
And the feeling back then was, well, this was like, I think it was mid-May when we were just starting to reopen. And I think the theory was among her friends, well, you know, now they're saying we can reopen, so, you know, we can hang out on the weekend.
What percentage of your cases are you finding symptom free?
Very few.
Really?
Under 10%. Okay. Well, now I'm counting fatigue. The number one symptom we see is fatigue. More than fever, more than loss of taste, more than cough, fatigue. And so a common email we get or a common phone call we get is, the last 2, 3, 4 days, I'm just really tired.
Right.
They might even be asking for a blood count to check their thyroid or something. And we say, well, let's go ahead and check you for COVID. And sure enough, they're positive. There's an article, maybe you read about it in the paper, the comedian D.H. Huey collapsed on stage recently.
Yeah.
Had no symptoms whatsoever. And he tested positive. His doctor said he admitted he was fatigued and was trying to work through it. And so he had no symptoms. He just collapsed out of fatigue. So if you take away fatigue, there's quite a few of that, the respiratory symptoms. But if you count fatigue, I'd say 90-95% have symptoms.
And fever's been kind of an iffy question here. Is checking someone's temperature when they walk into your business, is that pretty much useless?
No, we do. We test all our employees every day. We check every patient that comes in every day, because if they have even a low-grade fever, we put them in their car and do a video visit. Because we don't want anybody in the office that could possibly be infected with anything right now, anyway. But in our case, it's been holding steady. 80% of positives had no fever at all. And very few are over 101. Most are 100 or less, like 99.9, 100.2, very low grade. So fever has not been a good predictor. But I would say that 80% do have some kind of fever.
Okay. I read where your typical case, you find on day one, there's fatigue and maybe a cough. By day two, there's some fever. By day three, there's a worsening cough. And then days 4 through 6, you get copious fluid in the chest. Which day should I call you? If I start feeling, which day is the day to call the doctor?
Well, what you just read was pretty much our experience until mid-late May. And now we're catching it much earlier, because of the first sign of a low-grade fever, the first sign of a mild cough, fatigue, people are calling us, so we're testing them. And if we can catch it early, we can get them to bed rest, we can get them on pulmonary hygiene, put them on a Z-Pak, zinc, get in the sinus spirometry, put them on an inhaler to open up their lungs. So we treat very aggressively. And so I'd want to find out that very as soon as you know you're fatigued or fever, day one is when we. Because remember, the swab still take the good swabs, the PCR, still take 3 to 5 days to get back. Mm. So you've got that little gap in there. Maybe they've gotten a little bit better, but it's, I warn everybody to count 5 business days.
Right. Never know. Now, you mentioned that one of your patients had suffered significant illness for up to 25 days and they were not a senior. Are you concerned about permanent lung damage in a patient that suffers for that long?
Yes, I am, because in my readings, when you look at X-rays, people who are severe, not mild cases, but people who are severe, had the cytokine storm where their lungs filled up with mucus and they had a hard time getting rid of the mucus, their X-rays are still abnormal months later. So I believe there will be scarring, and I believe they may need inhalers or have some kind of underlying lung problems many years, if not the rest of their lives. I don't mean debilitating with it on oxygen, but I think they may never be the same again as far as, being able to jog and run and all that kind of thing.
Wow. You've been using a regimen of the double Z's, zinc and zithromycin. Now, has that been working?
Hard to say. The literature says it does. I wasn't overly impressed, frankly. Okay. But it beats putting people on nothing and just telling them to sit there. So the zithromycin has an effect on some viruses that look like bacteria. But more importantly, it's essential to not get a secondary bacterial infection. If you're already fighting COVID and then you get a bacterial infection on top of that, that could be the ballgame. So the Z-Pak is really there for two reasons. It might help against COVID, but we don't want you getting a secondary bacterial infection. Zinc has actually good numbers against the common cold, and the coronavirus is the cause of the common cold. That was the theory in using it. Because we're starting it so early and our cases are milder, I would say it's helping. I'm not sure it's really a cure.
I think the dumb guy question now for me would be the body naturally gets zinc from red meat or meats. Are meat eaters less susceptible?
I read something about that, and the answer was no. I mean, somebody thought of that, and the answer was no. Okay. And you think maybe, vegetarians, vegans might, because they're healthier in general, but there was no link with diet that I read.
Okay. Now, you also do a COVID cocktail. Can you describe what a COVID cocktail is?
That's worked almost better than the double Z. The COVID cocktail is, if you have respiratory symptoms, it doesn't work preventively. Except the inhaler. The inhaler works preventively. So the first sign of any congestion at all, we give Sudafed, which is over-the-counter, combined with Phenergan. Phenergan is a prescription cough medicine, but it's a mucolytic, meaning it breaks up mucus.
Okay.
If you don't want to take a prescription, a milder form is over-the-counter with a drug called Mucinex. And then thirdly, we give an inhaler to everybody. We also donate to them a pulse ox machine, a little unit you put on your finger that tells you your oxygen level. Should be over 92, 93 as a rule. And by using all three of those, it keeps the airways open so they don't get that mucus settling in their chest. Because that's what we found the big problem is when they start saying, my chest is gurgling, I feel like I'm drowning, I feel like I'm coughing up all this gunk, that's when they're going to have major issues. So by giving this cocktail, we kind of keep their lungs open and get rid of the mucus.
And you utilize it for the duration of the illness?
Until they're not congested, which is about 7 to 10 days, yeah.
Okay.
We've had good results with it, but we don't have a volume to do a double-blind study, and I don't think it's ethical for me not to give it to half the people. So we're giving it to everybody, and we've noticed very good effect from it, but we're not trying to do a New England Journal study here. We're trying to keep our patients from being in the hospital or ventilators. So it seems to be working, considering we've had 110 cases and we have had no deaths or even no ventilators out of the 110.
Okay. Hats off there. Now, once a cough or air hunger develops, you've been teaching something called the pulmonary hygiene, pulmonary toilet. Mm-hmm. It's aggressive. What exactly is that?
Yeah, it's something I learned when I was a medical student at the VA hospital, but every doctor learned it somewhere. There's three exercises. The first is called turn, cough, and deep breathe. They're in their bed, and they turn to the left, cough really, really hard, take a deep breath, turn to the right, cough really, really hard, and go back and forth. Imagine some honey in the bottom of a jar and you're trying to mobilize it. So that takes the mucus on the sides of the chest if you go back and forth. The second is called incentive spirometry. Most people can buy them on eBay or Amazon. There's little balls you suck in and the balls go up. They could replicate that just by taking very deep breaths. We find that's essential. We got to keep those lungs as wide open as possible. So they do that 3-4 times a day for 5 minutes where they raise the balls with their deep breaths. And then the third is called percussion and drainage. You need a partner for that, probably in a gown and a mask and gloves. And they take their shirt off and on their bare back, they cup their hands. Their partner cups their hands and they beat like bongo drums on the back for a good 2-3 minutes. You're shaking the mucus out of the lungs that way. You're mobilizing the mucus. Okay. And then they step outside for a minute and the patient coughs their heads off to bring up that mucus. Then their friend comes back in. They pound another 2-3 minutes, step out, they cough that up. So the three together keep the lungs free of mucus and keep the lungs open. Okay. We found that very effective.
And I mentioned air hunger, and air hunger, of course, can reduce the amount of oxygen to, obviously, the lungs, but also oxygen to the blood. Do you find yourself not only treating the virus itself, but the residual maladies caused by the virus in the patient?
Yeah, we haven't had, like heart attacks or anything like that. I know some places have. But we check their pulse ox. That's that machine on the finger I talked about.
Yes.
And when we diagnose them, they're usually like 93, 94, 95. But when they get air hunger, they're down in the 80s, and that's dangerous. So that's why we do all this. And sure enough, after we give them the inhaler and all these exercises, it'll go up to the mid-90s, which is where they need to be. The trouble with air hunger, as soon as the patient says, I can't get enough air, I have air hunger, I feel hungry for air, you know, we kind of roll our eyes and do a sign of the cross because we know that's going to be a long, hard road for that patient to... Right. To get that stuff out.
Right. Now, when last we spoke, you had successfully used hydroxychloroquine as a last resort on some patients. You've been using it successfully for years to treat lupus for 20 plus years. Now, in those specific cases where you had to use it, it was either treat the patient with it or death. Was that the choice?
Well, I don't know if they would have died. We categorized the mild, moderate, severe. And when they get bad air hunger, they're crossing into severe. And if it's just fatigue and a sore throat, that's mild. So we used it in moderate to severe cases. And we've used it a total of 20 times now. We just used our 20th 2-3 weeks ago. And we've had 19 what I would call successes where the patient pretty quickly got better. We had one failure. The patient had to go into the ICU, didn't get ventilated. But was treated there with the remdesivir, the protease inhibitor, and that worked. So we've had a failure out of 20. It's a drug I'm very comfortable with. I really never intended to cause any political statement with this or to cause any...
Well, you're just a doctor trying to cure people, man. I know. We get it.
Well, because the FDA actually, first of all, gave it emergency authorization and actually... mandated that the reserve that they had it in reserve, and they gave it to pharmacies across the country for that. And so at one point it was pretty standard therapy. Now the two studies that debunked it both had to be retracted because it looked like they were politically motivated. But the FDA did remove its authorization, but it was based on one, in my opinion, controversial study.
Right.
So whether or not it's a good drug or whether we can use it is debatable. Fortunately, we haven't been using it, but not because of the controversy. It's just that our cases have stayed mild for the most part, so we haven't needed to use it. But I would still use it if we felt it would save the patient's life, sure.
Okay. And doctors that are less comfortable using it, is there any substitute that they should consider instead of it?
Not really. The remdesivir is something that's only given IV, so it's only given in the hospital. Okay. So we're talking about somebody at home who has a bad case. The only other thing really shown consistently to help is the steroid called Decadron, dexamethasone. And Decadron has been shown over and over to save people in the hospital, given either orally or IV. They don't have good numbers on it as an outpatient, but we've used it once with very good results. At first, they said don't use steroids, but it was hypothetical. Decadron is a steroid. But using Decadron, I think, would be a very reasonable and safer, well, I don't know about safer, but a more acceptable alternative.
Okay. All right. Now, I read where you had stated on average it takes 30 days to turn from swab positive to swab negative, and almost all swab positive cases are showing antibodies, but it's taking up to 60 days to do that. Now, whether the antibodies will prevent reinfection or not, what's your first indication that they will prevent reinfection?
Well, the fact is, and some of the numbers are different now. The numbers you're reading were true about 6 weeks ago.
Okay.
We have better numbers now. Unfortunately, it's taking up to 120 days to see the IgG appear. So it's taking longer than we expected. But so far, almost every swab-positive patient has gotten IgG antibodies eventually. Okay. Any other virus, any other condition, that defines immunity. So if you have IgG in your body against chickenpox, if you had it when you were a kid, and so you're immune from chickenpox. There's no debate there. We know that's true. So far, none of our IgG patients have gotten it a second time, have had a relapse, okay. Which tells me so far the IgG is working. You know, okay. So every stand, we check the antibody, everybody who's positive, and they're all IgG negative. So if you get diagnosed today with COVID, 100% of the time they're IgG negative, which means they were not protected. So we won't know much more till the fall when we keep on seeing positive cases and we see how many were IgG positive. If there are significant cases this fall that are IgG positive, then it's not working, the antibody. But I think it should. I realize the media seems to point to a lot of disbelief or they're kind of saying, well, who knows if that it works, but it really should work.
Okay. Theoretically.
Yeah. I mean, well, it does in every other virus, so I think it should work in this one, too.
Okay. And I guess my question is that since it's infecting so many people, since the amount of people being infected is so large, is it possible that it could mutate and prevent successful herd immunity?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, but it already proved it mutated once, but not enough to get two things. So far, we've not seen anybody get two different COVIDs, at least in my practice, and anywhere else that I could think of, really. There's been relapses where people get swab negative and then turn positive again up to 2 weeks later. And the number one cause of that's always activity. They just didn't stay in bed long enough.
Right.
As soon as they test swab negative, they go out and they party and they have fun and they exercise and then they get a relapse. We've seen that a dozen times.
And you've mentioned before that the number one factor in improving your health is bed rest.
Yeah, it's amazing that the patients that stay off their feet, bed, couch, recliner, bathe and shower is okay, but beside that, they do great. In almost every case where the patient stayed symptomatic a long time, they cheated. They went and planted a plant in the backyard. They went to clean their garage out, or they just didn't stay off their feet. So that's been actually shown by multiple studies. So it's pretty definite.
Okay. I read where you had 25 patients that had identical symptoms to the COVID-19 cases, air hunger, copious mucus, and near drowning. However, they were swab negative multiple times. What was the explanation for that?
Yeah, I mean, now it's up to, if I rewrote the article now, it'd be like 30, 35. We have about 10 more. most of those now have recovered, those 25. Okay. But it took a while.
Good.
Well, some people said, well, the swabs aren't that accurate, so they're false negatives. But that's not the case. The PCR swabs are actually very, very accurate. So I don't believe they're false negatives. I believe there was a mutation, and a lot of other studies have shown this, where the swab was designed for the COVID of January, February, and March. But in early April, there was a mutation in America, and there must be a strain that looks different than the original COVID that the test doesn't pick up. This is a weak metaphor. There's influenza A and influenza B. They're both influenza, but they're different. strains and their different mutations. So when you test for them, you do an influenza A test, you do an influenza B test. You can't do just one; you have to do both. So I think this mutated, and there's another COVID out there that isn't picked up by the typical swab. But we treat them the same way, so there's really no harm.
Now, in order to keep the hospital rooms and emergency rooms clear, how important is getting a regular flu shot this year?
Well, I think it's essential. Of course, any doctor's going to tell you that. So every year I think my patients get a flu shot. But this year it's critical because if you get COVID, the flu usually comes around every October. If you get COVID in, let's say, November or October, and then on top of that got the flu, that could be the ballgame. I mean, you'd be in the ICU or even worse. So it's the flu shot's not going to prevent COVID, but you just don't want to have both. That would be devastating.
So I guess my first question to you about July and August, I should have extended into November, and that's when we're really going to have a test.
Who knows? You look at the curves of other countries, and there was a peak, and then it went down almost to zero. We've not had that. We had a peak, and it dipped a little bit, and then it stayed up the whole time, and now it's going up even more. So is it possible you and I will talk in September and I'll say, oh gosh, there's hardly any cases now. Boy, it's almost gone. We might be saying that. I don't know.
Okay.
But right now it's spreading. It's the same thing. The penetrance is very, very low, meaning it's easy to catch, number one. And number two, there's a 14-day incubation period. So so meanwhile, you're spreading it for 14 days before you get your diagnosis. So that's why this is so easy to spread.
Right. And when we see states like Florida, Texas, and Georgia, whose numbers are skyrocketing right now, and those states in particular had some county healthcare agencies that found it hard to remain independent from the political arms, things as simple and obvious as like accurate reporting of numbers or advocating the wearing of masks. And here in Orange County, given that Dr. Nicole Quick faced opposition to her mask directive last month, not just from the uninformed members of the public, but from politicians who actually know better, do you have confidence that the current Orange County Healthcare Agency can remain independent?
No, I don't.
Okay.
That they should have totally supported Dr. Quick. I mean, they should have said, you know, I mean, in some countries, I think in Europe, there was like a €150 fine if you were caught. Found that it's kind of like talking on a cell phone while you're driving. They pull you over, they give you a ticket. You know?
Right.
They were fining people without wearing masks in parts of Europe. France, I think, was one of the countries that did that. And even though it wasn't such a high enough fine that it would be that devastating, it's just the whole idea. Nobody wants to get a fine. You know?
Right.
I don't think that would fly here, but that's what it's going to take to really get these things enforced.
Right. It takes enforcement. I mentioned to you last time you were on the program that I had a problem flying because it was like I was in a petri dish. What do you need to see before you'd feel comfortable flying across the country?
Oh, the cases are going to have to be way down. I mean, the curve's going to have to drop significantly. I haven't taken any vacation this year because of this, obviously. Not because I'm afraid to travel, because I'm so busy with this. So in order to not go crazy, I decided to take 3 or 4 weeks off in October.
Right.
And my wife and I are going to rent a car and just do a road trip and go to some national parks and hike and stay away from as many people as possible and just, drive and stay in small hotels and not do the big city things. And we're not going to fly. We're going to drive. So... The airlines have tried to do a good job by saying they actually recirculate the air. They suck the air up, and it gets filtered and put back in. But if somebody even coughs four rows over, it's going to get to you before it gets to the filter. So I would say, wearing the mask definitely helps. So if everybody has a mask on, that'll help. And if you have to fly, no question, it's okay to do that. But recreationally, I wouldn't fly right now, no.
Okay.
A lot of the cases came from cruises, boats, trains, buses. There's a lot of cases, not here in Orange County, but statewide. So I'd say any public transportation where there's a lot of people sitting in a confined space should be avoided.
Right. And certainly, no matter what, if you have to be in public transportation of any kind, masks, again, we can't say masks, masks, masks often enough.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely will blockade to 90%, which isn't 100%, but it's, and then if you're able to fit far from strangers, I mean, if you're with a spouse or a partner, of course, that's different. But, you know, if you just try to space yourself best you can, you want to put as much space between you and somebody that's positive. You have to kind of assume everybody's positive around you. So where would you go, you know?
Right. In a time of crisis, when your life is the most at risk, facts matter most. Dr. Greg DiNicola, thank you so much for coming on and providing these facts. He's with Caduceus Medical Group. He's the chief medical officer. I know you're busy, and we really appreciate your time, taking your time to do this.
Sure, Ed. Happy to do it.
Dr. Greg DiNicola, thank you very much.
Thank you.